Hi, I'm Damon Fairless, host of Hunting Warhead from CBC Podcasts and the Norwegian newspaper VG. Hunting Warhead follows a global team of police and journalists as they attempt to dismantle a massive network of predators on the dark web. Winner of the grand prize for best investigative reporting at the New York festivals and recommended by The Guardian, Vulture, and the Globe and Mail, you can find Hunting Warhead on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm El Amin Abdul Mahmoud.
And I am Catherine Cullen, sitting in for Rosemary Barton.
Hi, Catherine. Welcome to Party Lines.
Thanks, El Amin. Listen, through the past year, we have seen the Liberals serve up some big policy responses to this crazy pandemic. Take the CERB, for example. These are the policies that are usually the territory of the left. And as the Liberals continue to dip into that territory, well, where does it leave the NDP? They've got a big policy convention coming up this weekend, so I want to take a look at where they are hoping to stake their claim as parties get ready for a federal election sometime in the near future.
Well, listen, I have no plans this weekend, so I'm going to watch that entire convention. But before we get into that, this province, Ontario, is in another stay-at-home order. Why are some governments continuing to be reactive as opposed to proactive?
There is a lot to talk about.
So let's do it. Okay, Catherine, I struggle to figure out where to start with this one, but go with me for just a moment, okay?
I'm with you.
All right. So, you know, a year ago this week, my jaw was on the floor because I was watching people post and tweet and share that they were like filling out their forms for the CERB, for the CRB, that emergency recovery benefit that the government rolled out. And it was amazing to watch. It was amazing to watch because I'd followed politics long enough to know that from the rollout of the program to checks being in bank accounts, like, it was like a mere matter of weeks. And this is something that normally would have taken, you know, years to get going. And I was amazed by this because it sort of reminded me of the kind of pandemic responsiveness that we were at the start of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And now I'm finding that I'm watching the reverse. I'm shocked and amazed at watching governments not act or delay acting while they're listening to experts give advice. I'm in Ontario, where I have been through a rainbow of restrictions. There's been green, there's been yellow, there's been red zone, there's been red control zone, gray lockdown, white shutdown. No one knows what these mean. My job is to follow all of them. And I'm not sure what they mean 55% of the time. And now we find ourselves in another stay-at-home order. And one of the things that we heard from the Ontario government on Wednesday is that they are finally going to expand vaccine access to people over 18 in neighborhoods that are hit particularly hard in Toronto and Peel. Part of this is going to involve mobile vaccination clinics. They're going to make more effort to reach people in those neighborhoods and people over 18. So that's a much wider sort of swath of people. But here's the thing. It is coming after a delay, you know, after ICU admissions hit their highest levels in the pandemic in this province. And look, the vaccination part of all of this is welcome news. These are neighborhoods that are devastated by COVID-19 right now, but it still feels pretty late in the game. Like, after the Ontario government moved ahead with a shutdown a week ago, there was this whole week in between of more ICU admissions, more cases rising. And you just think that after a year of doing this, governments would get better at being proactive. So help me understand, you know, help me understand, because honestly, like, it's just been quite something watching governments that had so much initial flexibility just mm-hmm. become rigid, because you think after a year of doing this, you'd get better at it and not worse.
Yeah. And I don't know that I can help you make sense of all of it, but I can definitely say that I relate to that frustration, not just the fact that these measures weren't taken sooner. But if you look at a lot of the provinces that are being hardest hit right now, you have to remind yourself that quite a few of these provinces were actually relaxing measures just before yeah. things started getting really bad, right? You think about BC right before spring break. They decided to allow people to meet outdoors in groups of 10. Alberta was talking about relaxing measures. Ontario, you folks in Toronto were finally going to be able to get a haircut. And then the day, I think, before that was supposed to happen, all of a sudden, oh, wait a minute, things have gotten so bad. Quebec, it's a similar story. And you do have to ask yourself, why when there were certainly a lot of medical experts out there sounding the alarm, were we actually relaxing restrictions only now to be confronted with what, let's be honest, like this is a scary scenario right now when you hear what doctors are talking about in terms of hospital capacity and whatnot. Yeah. I think one thing maybe we're not always, the media is not always terrific about, and I hesitate to refer to the media as just one big monolith. I do think we have to acknowledge that like part of this discussion is that lockdowns are really hard for people, right? And maybe we don't always take a beat because of the severity of the consequences of not putting these extreme measures in place because there are lives at stake. Maybe we don't always take a beat and say, listen, this is making a lot of people's lives a lot more difficult. Certainly, yes, business owners who have to see their businesses close, but there are a lot of people who are struggling in terms of their mental health, their financial health. And every time we do this, it is hard on people. I was really struck when Alberta Premier Jason Kenney talked about, well, you know, on the one hand, we have people who want really hard lockdown measures. And then on the other hand, there are people who don't believe the threat. And he said, Alberta's approach has been to find a sensible, safe middle ground. But I think we have to ask ourselves, is the middle ground really what we want right now? You know, like if on the one hand, the potential consequences are hospitals being overwhelmed and a dramatic increase in the number of people who could die, is the middle ground really where we want to draw the line? I think we can see the challenges that are caused by lockdowns, you know, surgeries being delayed and whatnot, and acknowledge that those are not things that we want, but also acknowledge that some of the stuff on the other end of the spectrum, that is pretty darn scary too.
Yeah, to me, you know, middle grounds are for like when we're ordering appetizers for the table, you know, and we can maybe all agree on like mozzarella sticks. That feels like a universal thing we can all agree on. But
we don't want the mozzarella stick approach to the pandemic. Yeah.
No, because it's clearly not working, and it's making more and more people anxious. And to give an idea, I think, of just how much these plans have been unresponsive to the reality on the ground. Mm-hmm. In Toronto, for example, The Local reported this week that the area around Jane and Finch has the worst COVID rates in the city, in Toronto. But it also has the lowest rates of vaccinated people in the city. And then you contrast that with the five wealthiest neighborhoods in Toronto, and they have much lower rates of infection, but they have the highest vaccination rates. That tells us plain and simple that like the vaccines are just not reaching the people that they need to reach. Now it is looking like the Ontario government wants to fix some of this. We mentioned earlier that Doug Ford announced that they're going to be expanding this vaccine eligibility so that they can hit all those people over the age of 18 in the areas that are having a really hard time with COVID-19 in Toronto and Peel. But also, Doug Ford made it quite clear that paid sick leave from the province is not going to be a part of any of their new efforts. And this is an area that we've heard so much expert advice about. I think I remember in just like November, the Toronto Star and the Globe, between the two of them, they ran half a dozen editorials in the span of maybe 2 weeks saying, okay, we need to figure out what we're going to do about paid sick leave, because there is a federal program, but it's been criticized by advocates who've said that it's not nearly enough. Well, where's the follow-up to this? What are provincial governments doing to supplement that? And I think it has kind of felt like a bit of Groundhog Day, where you hear Premier Doug Ford say, well, everything's on the table. And honestly, I think it's fair to say at this point that the phrase everything is on the table has become somewhat of a Doug Ford meme, because it feels like he says it every day or every other day. And at this point, I have seen the table, and I don't think I've ever seen sick leave on this table. So, no, not everything's on the table. And so it feels like governments across the country have been gun-shy about doing the thing that works, or at least the thing that experts are telling us to try. And it is a bit puzzling, particularly when compared to the actions they were so excited to take at the start of the pandemic.
Well, let's push a little bit more into the why. And like, obviously, neither you nor I is in any particular premier's head. But like, let's talk about Doug Ford again for a moment. That incredibly compelling head scratching, head banging against the wall moment from his news conference the other day, where we're learning as he's speaking that schools in Toronto are going to be shut down. Already we've heard that schools in Peel region just outside Toronto, so like huge swaths of Ontario's population, all these kids not going to be able to go to school. And at the same time, the premier is chastising people for going to the malls that he left open.
Make sure you know, when you can, stay at home. We understand you got to get out, get fresh air, God bless you, but do it responsibly. But a lot of people were going into the malls and doing their little wander around and coming out with no bags. So that tells me they're just out for an evening or a daily jaunt. You can't do that. You know, if you have an essential item that you have to buy, and, you know, I'm sorry, but going to the malls is not essential. What's essential is going to buy food, going to buy medicine out of the pharmacies, and getting your vaccines.
So the obvious question is, if it's not essential and they don't want folks going there, why, Elamin, can you tell me, why did they leave the malls open? Which, I mean, they're about to be shut down, right? They are being shut down now, but still.
I mean, the mind truly boggles. There's a part of the clip that was really interesting to me where he seemed like he was incensed that people were coming out with no bags.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is actually a tell. Like, I genuinely think that is a tell in the sense of saying, well, look, the reason the malls are open is because they felt a lot of pressure to help out the retail sector that has been struggling, that's been hit really hard during this pandemic. And it's like, well, if you're going to go out to the mall, you can at least have the decency to buy something while, you know, increasing the amount of exposure that you have out there. But no, like, it is hard to follow a logic there. It is hard to conclude that this is based on the mountains of advice that they have been given over the past few weeks. And by the way, we've heard from many doctors who've said, you know what, that last shutdown that we did in January, it worked. Like, the stay-at-home order worked because it ended up reducing the number of people who were coming to the hospital regularly. And after every day being hammered on this, the province now is deciding to move into a stay-at-home order. But that is new. And like, it took such a long time to be responsive to that.
And so the question, I guess, becomes like, is this in part, is this reticence that we're seeing? I mean, we're talking a lot about Ontario, but we gave the examples from the rest of the country of this sort of push-pull. Is it about, how much of it is about economics? How much of it is about the pushback that they get from certain sectors, definitely of the population, who just cannot tolerate this anymore? I mean, I think schools is a really interesting example of that because there's so much pressure around that particular issue, right? Parents want to keep their kids safe, but they're also really struggling when all of a sudden all your kids are home and you have, you know, three kids trying to do online learning at once and you're still trying to do your job at the same time. How much of it is about public pressure? How much of it is about economic pressure? How much of it is ideological too, right? I mean, some of these big governments, Alberta, Ontario, Quebec, they are more conservative-leaning governments. And certainly one argument I saw being floated yesterday was someone saying that they found it really disconcerting that people would see people abusing the freedoms that governments have given them. I guess the example would be going to the mall and not buying anything. And that people's reaction would be, well, the government should stop giving people freedom. And I appreciate that that is something that sends a chill down some people's spines. But the only thing I would say is, well, now the freedom is just being taken away a week or two later. You're still losing your freedom. And it's going to have a knock-on impact in emergency rooms and literally, like, loss of life, you know? Was going to the mall really worth it?
I think we can reasonably say that, you know, at the start of the pandemic a year ago, there was, like, this sense of we're all in this together. Like, that sense really prevailed. And part of that was also, hey, the sense of we're all at risk for this thing because we don't really understand it. And then that's when governments got inventive and they were trying to protect all of us. But as the pandemic wore on, it actually became pretty clear that there is a disproportionate effect, that this pandemic is not an equal experience. It is not a coincidence, I think, that the areas of policy and action line up with the most disenfranchised and disempowered people. Mm-hmm. People with pretty, you know, with not a lot of political capital, young people, people in precarious working conditions. I think like enough experts have been saying that these are the people who will be hurt if we keep doing what we're doing. And yet governments are not showing up at the speed that they once did. And I think like the only thing that's changed since last April is we now know who's been most heavily impacted.
Amina is an activist during the Arab Spring. Her blog, Gay Girl in Damascus, attracts readers from around the world. When she's mysteriously abducted, her followers mobilize, desperate to save her. What they find shocks them. I'm Samira Moyeddin, the host of Gay Girl Gone, a new 6-part series from CBC. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
So let's face it, this whole pandemic situation means that a lot of us do not have a lot on our social calendars these days. Not necessarily a lot going on outside of Zoom meetings. And so, Elamine, you might be interested to know, as you plan your plans for the weekend, that both the NDP and the Liberals are having big virtual policy conventions this weekend. And I do want to talk about this for a minute, even if you're not feeling like tuning in, because I think it does actually set up a really interesting contrast in terms of what is going on in this country politically, due in large part to the pandemic, right? Think about what the federal Liberals have done since this pandemic started. You talked about it a little bit earlier with the idea of the CERB, right? We've seen the Liberals really reach into some more traditional left-leaning territory, these massive government programs like CERB, like the wage subsidy, sick leave, money to help businesses, money to help the healthcare system, right? Just shoveling billions of dollars out the door. It's a big moment for big government. And I think that sets up a really interesting question. Yeah, sure, about the Liberals, but let's talk for a minute about Jagmeet Singh and the NDP. I think we need to ask ourselves at this moment, where Canadians are really dependent on a lot of these big programs, and we're thinking about what kind of society we want to have after the pandemic, too. What's mm-hmm. left for the left?
Nice. I love a pun. This sure makes my day. Listen, it's a really good question to ask, because I've been thinking lately that it is not immediately obvious to me. I don't know about you, but it's not immediately obvious to me why the Liberals should be the party of the pandemic recovery. I mean, certainly they've made the pitch that they are. They are the government. They've been rolling out these programs. But we have seen the pandemic, I think, reorder the expectations that people have of government in just a few months. The things that we used to hear from government say, well, this would take a long time to do, they've just happened in such a short period of time. So I think one of the consequences coming out of this pandemic will be people will look to governments to act much faster and also act in a much broader way, in a way that is like, you know, genuinely just like far reaching. I mean, is anyone trying to hear a fiscal restraint conversation right now? I think it's really hard to imagine that being a policy plank for anyone.
Not even the Conservatives, right?
Exactly. Like, yeah. They have no appetite for that right now. Understandably so, because I think Canadians are not, maybe anecdotally, but I think from what I'm hearing from a lot of people is that, like, that's the last thing on their mind is, like, the size of the deficit and mm-hmm. the size of the debt. So this might be a time to reimagine what government is for and say, actually, incrementally broadening what the government does or doesn't do doesn't work. We've learned that people are really vulnerable, that everything can change in an instant. So not only is it the time for big government, it is a time for like the biggest possible government. That is an argument that is available to the NDP. It is not an argument that they're exercising right now. The argument they're exercising is, hey, those things that the Liberals said they're going to do, we're going to actually just deliver on them. That seems to be the big repeated line that Jagmeet Singh throws around. And he throws around about things like something that is far-reaching when it comes to pharmacare, something that is far-reaching when it comes to mental health. But can they imagine bigger? Of course they can. And a policy convention is a good way to do that. It opens up this opportunity of saying, okay, what are the policies that we want to actually adopt? It's just a matter of figuring out whether they want to say, hey, we can do the things that the liberals do, but better, or here's a bunch of things that you haven't even imagined, and now let's do them.
And there's a couple of interesting things that have been happening with the NDP somewhat quietly, I guess, during the pandemic. I mean, let's face it, the Prime Minister really does end up being center stage during a lot of this. He's having his weekly, at one point, daily news conferences, right, updating Canadians. He's in the spotlight. But while all of that has been going on, polls do show that quietly the NDP's been gaining, you know, a point here, a point there. They have been making some progress. And maybe that does reflect what you're talking about, this greater acceptance of big government programs. The other thing, and this surprised me as somebody who's, you know, steps away from Parliament Hill, but when did Jagmeet Singh become one of the political veterans in the room? He's actually the but it's true. It's about 4 years now that he's been leading that party, right? And that, other than Justin Trudeau, makes him one of the longest standing party leaders. So he's got a bit of experience under his belt. The question to me is, how does the NDP convince Canadians that they can pull off things that the Liberals can't? For instance, a lot of the argument that you hear them making right now is, well, hey, you needed us there, Canadians, in order to ensure that the CERB was as generous as it was, or that the wage subsidy was as generous as it was. And they point to particular discussions in Parliament, you know, around the time these programs were rolled out. I don't think pointing to the past is necessarily going to win you a lot of points with voters when you're actually in an election campaign, whenever that might be. But the other thing is that at the end of the day, the Liberals are the ones who did those things. I think in most Canadians' minds, they associate those programs with the Liberals. So this is where the NDP is trying to pitch some of those big ideas you're talking about. End to private long-term care, national pharmacare program, student debt relief. But I think they have to convince Canadians that they can really do it and that they can do it more effectively than the Liberals will. And that, I think, is going to be a big challenge for them.
It's interesting that you say that Jagmeet Singh has been the leader for 4 years, because one of the big things that have changed in the last 4 years has been the name AOC, Alexandria mm-hmm. Ocasio-Cortez. And I genuinely think that through her sort of superstardom as a political presence in the U.S., and of course her dabblings in Canadian politics, that time that she played Among Us with Jagmeet Singh, she's someone who's raised the profile. She, along with, of course, Bernie Sanders, have raised the profile of a lot of ideas that I think before used to be dismissed as kind of more closer to the fringe leftist ideas. Mm-hmm. So now you're seeing a bunch of ideas at this policy convention, ideas like taxing all wealth over $1 billion at 100%. Now, there's no telling whether that's going to pass or not. It's just a matter of, like, this is something that is being discussed by the party. They're also discussing things like phasing out the Canadian Armed Forces. I'm not sure that those things will play well, but they are ambitious ideas. And it's interesting for the party to consider something that is that high stakes, because I think, to me, in my mind, it's been a minute since the NDP has put something on the table that's been really high stakes. It says, actually, we're going to move our flag all the way over here because we think this is where people are. And so this rising superstardom of certain figures in the U.S. and in the U.S. left may have an impact on how far left they can feel empowered to go.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question, because you look at the example of AOC, but she is a Democrat. Obviously, the system is different in the United States, but she's somebody who's leaning a little bit left within one of the two traditional governing options in the United States, as opposed to being the NDP, where there's always been this question of federally, can they really hold on to power? And it does make me think, like, I totally see the enthusiasm around AOC and why Jagmeet Singh is trying to attach himself to that, I guess, to be a part mm-hmm. of that kind of excitement. But really, you don't have to think back that far to Jeremy Corbyn, the UK Labour leader, and how there was a lot of enthusiasm around him, and it was sort of twinned with Bernie too, and this idea that that was what was going to work for the NDP. And then when things did not go so well for Mr. Yes. Corbyn. Suddenly, we're not talking about that anymore. I also think one of the challenges with what you're talking about, some of these more outside the box, let's call them, policy proposals that may not even make it onto the virtual convention floor. Jagmeet Singh actually had to say on that the question about like getting rid of the armed forces. Well, one of their policy proposals is to have the military help across the country when it comes to vaccinations. So he did sort of have to say, right. that's not what I'm necessarily in favor. Because it's going to undermine this other plan we have. So that's something of a balancing act he has to deal with too, right? Like, if you want to be considered a credible option for people who are maybe already thinking about the Liberals, do you necessarily want to go too far left? But if you're just saying the same things they are and you don't have the same kind of experience governing, I mean, this is where the NDP's got to decide where to draw the line right now.
That is a sound from the deep archives that we've dug up, and we just like to listen to it and say, remember when Catherine, remember when that was a sound that you heard?
You're bringing me to tears, Elamine.
Listen, it's gonna be a while yet. However, it is also mercifully the sound of last call here on this podcast, and last week's question might have honestly set a new record for how many responses we got.
People have a lot of feelings after you and Rosemary asked, how are high real estate prices affecting you in your part of the country? How long might it take for you to save for a down payment for a house?
Oh my God, people were ready to talk about this one. So we heard from people from all across the country. A listener in BC said, we are trying our best to save for a down payment, but there's always another problem, another bill, another student loan payment, another emergency. God forbid you collected CERB last year and have to pay back taxes on it this year. It feels like I'm going to be a renter forever.
A listener in Ontario wrote, how long would it take me to save for a house? If I save $10,000 a year, property values go up by 15. If I save 15,000, they go up by 20. I don't need the market to slow or calm down. I need it to crash.
Yeah, that person was not exaggerating. That is sometimes what it feels like. One millennial in Alberta told us, I constantly count myself fortunate that I own my house. I live in Edmonton and got a tiny inheritance from my deceased grandparents, which helped with a down payment. Had I continued to live in Toronto, this could never have happened. We also heard from someone in Toronto who bought a house this past week, who said, we wanted to wait until the pandemic was more or less over, but the prices are going up so fast that if we had waited until the fall, our options would have been severely limited. And here's another answer that stood out to me. We are both elder millennials, 85 babies, and if we'd known that starter home actually meant forever home, we probably would have made different choices.
Elder millennials. That's an interesting one. But we are going to give the last word to this person who wrote in to say, buying a home isn't even on my radar. I'm single, work remotely, and like the flexibility. There are other ways to earn equity, status, and stability beyond home ownership.
I do not like well-adjusted people, but fine. That is, you know, live your life. I'm so happy for you. Thanks a lot. I'm just kidding. That sounds amazing. Congratulations. So this week, we'd like to know, what kind of actions do you want to see from your provincial government right now? Do you feel like they're doing enough to curb the spread of COVID-19? Please tweet us. I'm at Elamine88.
I'm at Cass_Cullen.
And throw in the hashtag. The hashtag is Party Lines. Let us know what you think.
And that is it for Party Lines this week from CBC News and CBC Podcasts. I'm Catherine Cullen, senior reporter for CBC News.
And I'm Elamine Abdul Mahmoud, senior not going to the mall person and culture writer for BuzzFeed News.
Rosemary Barton is going to be back behind the microphone next week.
Thanks for filling in, pal.
Happy to do it.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.